extremely lucky it hadn't caused any significant organ damage. In fact, they were all lucky. Without Sammy, Kate had no idea where they would be with this research.
Okay, I got this,
Sammy said with an exhale. She tapped at the laptop.
I'm engaging the connection.
Wayne shifted nervously. Anything we need to prepare for?
Not if we've done our job right, Kate said.
And if you didn't?
Then get ready to run.
Wynn turned slightly to look down the corridor.
All systems are booting, Sammy said. The processing algorithm is reading incoming signals.
A flurry of text scrolled across the computer screens, each color-coded to represent different signals. Hundreds of messages scrolled before the team. Prisoners incoming, one said. Squads requesting access to transport tunnels. Supplies requested for forward operating units. Everything was in decipherable words, although the meanings weren't perfectly clear. Kate assumed squads referred to human collaborators, and supplies meant weapons or food. Finding the information they were looking for was like trying to keep her eye on a single rock in an avalanche.
Sammy, is it possible to isolate signals with keywords? Kate asked.
We need the most important details first.
Just give me a few words. I can narrow it down right now.
Kate thought about their most pressing concerns.
See if you can narrow down the next outposts they're attacking.
Sammy typed a couple commands into her program. Seconds later, the clutter on the screens cleared to reveal a few select communication intercepts. A stab of fear coursed through Kate when she saw the messages isolated by Sammy's filtering. One stood out to her. It was their location. They all knew that another attack was inevitable, but seeing the outpost in Lower Manhattan as an immediate target chilled her to the core.
Sergeant Wynn, Radio Commander Massey, Kate said.
And say what?
That it's time to leave, Kate said. We're a target, and there's no telling when this attack will happen.
Shit,
Wynn hesitated.
Go,
Kate said. He nodded and went topside to deliver the news. Kate continued to work with the team.
We could try sending out a message to stop the attack, Leslie offered.
Sammy shook her head.
We're still trying to make sure we understand all the signals. If we try communicating back now, it'll be a red flag to them. I need more time.
Wynn returned 20 minutes later.
Dr. Lovato, he said, sounding nervous. The president said she isn't leaving without you.
I'm not going anywhere, Kate said.
She said she knew you would say that.
Kate looked over her shoulder.
What else did the president say?
That she won't evacuate until she's sure there's an imminent threat. And if you think it's safe enough for your team, it's safe enough for her.
Ron, Leslie, and Sammy all looked at Kate for orders.
Keep working, Kate said. Sammy, any evidence of when this attack is expected? I can scan for more info, but it might take a bit.
For the next 15 minutes, they collected more data, but some of it was difficult to decode. Just when Kate felt they were about to get a real answer, a loud thump resonated through the tunnel. Dust and dirt fell from the ceiling, plopping into the water. Strands of webbing broke free, hanging like dead snakes.
What the hell was that? Wynn said.
More loud thumps shook the tunnel. These were more powerful. It sounded like boulders slamming on the surface above. Kate was interrupted by a cacophony of explosions above ground. Cracks formed in the ceiling, dumping dirt in torrential columns.
Move!
Wynn grabbed Kate. The rest of the soldiers backed away, their rifles aimed at the dark passage. Sammy grabbed a computer, then hobbled to scoop up the microelectric arrays.
Sammy, leave them! Kate yelled.
Ron and Leslie helped the injured engineer, and together, the team hurried the best they could through the shallow water, but their speed was hampered by Sammy's wounded gait. Explosions boomed above the tunnel as they moved. The webbing recoiled, as if the throbbing tissue itself was trying to retreat. Kate reached the entrance of the cavern just as the thuds tapered off. Shaking, she looked back into the tunnel. Piles of dirt and rock protruded from the shallow water, but it hadn't collapsed. Wynn aimed his rifle at the steps leading out of the hole.
Clear.
The science team and soldiers made their way up the stairs to the sight of fires raging across the former construction site. Screams sounded in the distance, and Kate spotted figures running from the flames. Black smoke plumed away from tents and buildings. Wynne guided them forward cautiously, around blackened craters pocking the memorial site. Trees burned, their branches raining embers. Kate's respirator started to fog up. She took it off. The odor of charred flesh and smoke stung her nostrils. She coughed as she followed Wynne.
"We've got to find the president," Kate said.
Wynne pulled out his handgun.
"You know how to use this?"
"Of course."
He handed the sidearm to her.
"Just in case. Follow me and stay close."
"Sammy, Ron, Leslie, stay here with the other guards," Kate said.
Wynne led Kate around the fires sizzling across the memorial. Several trucks and cars were destroyed. Twisted, simmering metal was all that remained of the vehicles. She paused when she saw the mangled rotors of a helicopter. Not just any helicopter. Marine One was a flaming heap of debris.
"There!" Wynne shouted.
He sprinted toward the command tent where Commander Massey stood outside trying to organize the emergency response on a radio. Flames danced on top of the tent as four Secret Service agents pushed open the flaps to escape. Two aimed at Wynne and Kate as they approached.
"Easy," Wynne said. "I've got Dr. Kate Lovato with me."
"Kate,"
a voice cried. President Ringgold pushed out from behind the agents. Part of her suit coat was torn, and ash covered the side of her face. S.M. Fisher and a few other familiar faces streamed out of the tent.
"Are you okay?" Ringgold asked Kate.
"I'm fine," Kate said. "And you?"
Ringgold nodded.
"Scared, but not hurt."
"What happened?"
Kate said, looking around in shock.
"Bats," said one of the agents. "They came out of nowhere, an entire swarm packed with explosives."
Kate raised a hand to shield her eyes from the glare of the late afternoon sun. She slowly turned to look at the rooftops around the memorial, most of them burning or destroyed. Her heart sank when she saw the last Apache helicopter. Smoke drifted away from the destroyed machine. It wouldn't be long before night set in. And now they were stranded. By the time Nick returned to his two-bedroom apartment, his wife and two daughters were asleep. Only a meager yellow glow bled under the door to the apartment from the outer corridor. He used that weak light to cross the otherwise dark living room and nudge open the door to his bedroom.
"Nick," Diana said groggily.
"Is that you?"
"Yes. I'm sorry to wake you."
He slid into bed and kissed her cheek.
"You were gone longer than you said."
"We had to run some new security ops," he replied.
"Everything okay?"
"Yes."
She turned slightly.
"We're safe?"
"Yes."
It was the same thing she always asked when they went to bed, and his response was no different than before. After so much time living in the wild, on the run, and trying to survive, she still hadn't grown accustomed to the safety this base provided. He hadn't either. This base was one of the most protected and largest in the Allied States territory. His side was also handedly winning the war. But he never forgot they were still located in enemy territory. Living here had perks, though. Their own apartment, for one. Almost every other family lived in tents in the open hangar-style chamber a few floors below. Many of the rank-and-file soldiers did, too, including Ray. Diana took a deep breath, and Nick drew closer to her. He hadn't slept for a full night in days. Feeling the warmth of his wife and the comfort of a mattress and blankets made sleep come easily. He slept until the sounds of voices jerked him awake. Reaching out for Diana, he found her side of the bed empty. Blinking, he shot up, trying to see in the dark, windowless room. Light filtered in under the closed door. He put on his pants and scooped up his pistol, then he opened the door. His family was seated at the kitchen table. They weren't alone. An ugly grin from Ray's battered face greeted him. The man was standing in the living room with his characteristic unsheathed machete hooked to his belt. Not exactly the face he wanted to see first thing in the morning. Nick looked to his daughters and forced a smile. Good morning, girls. Both Lily and Freya were drinking fresh-pressed apple juice and eating breakfast. Diana drank a mug of coffee. All benefits from his job as the second in command. Diana handed him a thermos of coffee.
Good morning, Dad,
Lily said with a wide smile. Freya avoided his gaze. Nick was tired, but he wasn't too tired to see Ray stare lustfully at his wife for more than a beat.
What are you doing here?
Nick growled at Ray. Ray flitted his gaze to Nick and smirked.
I came to get you.
Why?
You're late.
Nick looked at his watch, cursing under his breath. He was already half an hour late to the command center. Pete would chew his ass out if he didn't hurry. Rushing back into his bedroom, Nick changed into his fatigues. He brushed his teeth at the sink, then took a swig of water, grabbed his duty belt, and went back to the living room.
Leaving again?
Freya asked, rolling her eyes. Lily frowned when Nick nodded.
Got work to do.
But I'll be home for dinner, he said. Be good for your mom and study hard. Diana slipped a homemade granola bar in Nick's vest and gave him a peck on the cheek.
See you tonight, Nick said.
As he embraced his wife, he saw Ray looking at Diana again.
Son of a bitch.
Nick let go of Diana and followed Ray out of the room into the empty concrete hallway, his heart racing with anger. He knew the guy was trying to piss him off, but Nick was having a hard time not taking the bait. It didn't help that Ray immediately started running his mouth.
Hope you enjoyed your beauty sleep, 'cause Pete's pissed.
Ray was definitely baiting him, obviously still mad about when Nick had used his face as a punching bag.
I guess that's what happens when people sleep, Ray started to say.
Nick halted in the hallway.
You don't learn, do you? It's almost like you want to get your ass kicked again.
Ray raised his cut chin in anger.
We're down on men, Nick said. That's the only reason you're still alive, and while Pete might not let me kill you, that doesn't mean he won't let me take your tongue.
You,
Nick stepped up to him. Look at my wife again like that, and I'll cut your eyes out, too. He kept walking, leaving Ray to think about the threats. The click of boots sounded as Ray finally started to follow Nick to the stairwell. They took the 10 flights up to the command center. By the time Nick reached the top, he was only slightly winded. He took a sip of his coffee as he waited for Ray. The guy was in worse shape, and still a full 2 flights below. His machete clanked on the railing repeatedly. The dipshit must have thought it was extra badass to have it hanging from his belt without a sheath, but now he sounded like a dinner bell. Nick ate his granola bar as he waited. They didn't really need this guy. He was a piece of shit and not much of a soldier. They were probably just wasting resources keeping his fat ass fed. Would anyone really miss Ray if the guy tripped and took a tumble? Nick tucked his granola bar away and took another drink of coffee. Ray finally emerged on the landing below. Sweat beaded across his forehead. Halfway up, he stopped to catch his breath.
I wish the fucking elevators worked in this shithole, Ray said.
Hurry, Nick said, cracking a smirk. Don't want to piss Pete off more, right? Nick watched Ray climb the steps. With his head down, Ray sort of reminded Nick of his old deceased friend Alfred. But then Ray looked up with that crooked gaze he had directed at Diana.
Want some coffee? Nick asked. From an asshole like you?
Ray replied, his face drawn in disgust. Nick dangled the thermos in front of Ray's face. Ray swatted at it, then took a step back at the edge of the landing.
At least I have a reason for being late now, Nick said.
What?
Ray tilted his head. Nick kicked him square in the chest as hard as he could. Ray grunted and flew backward, arms flailing. He hit the stairs on his back and then rolled down them on his side. A sickening slurp sounded as his machete cut into his body. He tumbled down the rest of the stairs, smearing a trail of blood until he had come to a stop on the landing. Nick watched with grim satisfaction as Ray squirmed in a pool of blood.
That was an unlucky tumble, Nick said,
taking the stairs down. Ray lay there, gripping his side, staring at the wound in horror. Nick crouched next to him and smiled.
You're,
Ray stammered. You should have kept your mouth shut and your eyes to yourself, you piece of shit. Ray gurgled, trying to speak again.
What's that? Nick asked.
He leaned closer and cupped an ear to try and make out the words. Despite the horrendous injuries, Ray managed to speak clearly one last time.
I fucked your wife, he said.
18. The streets of Seattle stunk of rotting fruit. Fitz crouched next to a counter at an old food stall in Pike Place Market. Panes of waning sunlight fell through holes in the roof, illuminating long green vines. Mold and mildew grew up the walls of the abandoned market, plants reclaiming the food stands and souvenir shops. Ace and Dohai moved with Fitz between the plants sprouting from cracked floorboards. For the better part of the day, the trio had crept through the city toward their destination. Nature had almost completely reclaimed Seattle, and so had the variants in parts like the Space Needle. But so far, the three-man team had only encountered a few starving monsters daring to prowl in daylight, desperately searching for food. The soldiers had dispatched them quickly with hatchets and blades. But as they drew closer to CECO, Fitz didn't expect anything to continue this easily. The center was located a block north of Seattle University on East Pike Street. If all went well, they could simply take East Pike from their current location straight to the laboratory facility. Fitz walked through the dense plant matter, leaves and stems squishing under his blades with each step. Ahead, he saw an old bakery. The shelves inside had collapsed in a jumbled mess. A scratched and broken sign advertised fresh cupcakes. He thought of Rico, as he often did in places like this, wondering what it would have been like to visit this marketplace sampling foods with her. They would only worry about what they were going to eat next, rather than what was trying to eat them. He prayed she was safe with Beckham and Horn. The fact she was with them helped put his mind at ease. A distant howl wailed over the ruined city. He held up a fist, and the other two froze. Another variant shriek echoed through the empty streets outside the market. Had they been detected? Fitz counted the seconds, waiting for a third cry. It didn't come. After another minute, Fitz signaled for Dohai to take point. They exited back outside, staying behind abandoned cars lining the curbs. Shattered glass from the vehicles and storefronts sparkled on the concrete between the plants growing out of the street and sidewalk. Dohai advanced under the crumbling buildings. Scattered bones from animals and humans lay in clumps, marred by teeth marks and sun-bleached. Almost all of them appeared to be old skeletons that spoke to the slaughter that had taken place years ago during the First War. The team was halfway to the CECO building when another chorus of variant cries exploded somewhere to their east. Fitz shrank into the shadows of a storefront with Dohai and Ace. Clouds drifted across the sky, blotting the sun as they waited. The scratch of claws bounced against the walls of the neighboring buildings. Soon the scraping faded, and silence reigned again. Fitz waited another 10 minutes just to be sure. Again, the team advanced in combat intervals, moving slow and low. The closer they got to the CECO, the more often they heard the shrieks of variants and the popping of their joints. Fitz guessed they were drawing close to a pack. Dohai paused behind a moving truck with flat tires. Fitz lifted his rifle and zoomed in on a building 3 blocks away at the corner of Pike and 11th Avenue. All the black windows of the modern structure appeared intact, but red vines roped over the sides of it and out of its open doors. This was the CECO facility. Cocoons of red tissue covered what looked to be prey, humans and animals, suspended off the side of the building. A few variants crawled along the webbing, sniffing at their prey. But it was the 5 chimeras standing at the front entrance of the office that gave Fitz pause. They had a variety of weapons that included AK-47s, M16s, and shotguns. The monstrosities gazed about the street with their reptilian eyes. Fitz lowered his rifle and shared a knowing look with Dohai. This certainly confirmed something important was going on in CECO, but before they could figure out whatever it was, they had to get past the guards or find an alternative entry point. At their current location, he didn't see any.
"Got any ideas on entries?" Fitz whispered.
"Go in through the back," Ace said quietly.
"Might be a loading dock we can use. More cover there."
"Not a bad idea, but we're going to want cover to get there."
Across the street from CECO was a 6-story apartment building. It wasn't covered in webbing and looked like it had a great vantage. Fitz thought about their options. He didn't like what he had come up with, but it might be their only choice to proceed.
"Dohai, take position on the top floor of that apartment complex," Fitz whispered.
He hated sending the man up alone, but someone was going to have to go solo so they could split up.
"Cover Ace and me. We'll search for another entrance."
"Copy that," Dohai said.
He took off into an alley, then disappeared into the apartment building. Fitz waited nearly 10 minutes.
"I see him," Ace said, pointing up to a balcony.
Dohai was flat on his stomach, just barely visible over the edge. He flashed them a hand signal, indicating they were clear to move. Fitz took Ace across the street and headed north. They took a right when they reached a park overgrown with swaying wild grass. Then Fitz led them toward the back of the CECO building. Another variant howled from somewhere to their north, maybe inside the park. Ace and Fitz took shelter behind a burned-out vehicle halfway down the block. Rustling sounded somewhere on the street. Ace moved over to a van to cover them from the other direction. Birds suddenly exploded from nearby trees, tearing into the sky. Fitz saw the tall grass in the park shift as something moved through it. He prepared his rifle as a muscular variant burst out of the weeds, stopping to sniff the air and search the block with narrow yellow eyes. Ace peered out, rifle at the ready. Fitz waved him off.
"Not yet," he thought. "No need to blow their cover."
The creature caught a scent and dropped to all fours, skittering toward them. It paused halfway there, twisting to look over its spiny back. The grass shook, disgorging 2 more variants. They too dropped to all fours, spreading out over the street. Fitz's brain raced, trying to figure out what they had done wrong. Had the rub they had used to mask their scent worn off already, weakened by their boat trip through the Puget Sound? The beasts drew closer, no more than 20 yards away, their eyes raking across the trash strewn over the street. Fitz leveled his rifle, ready to fire if the beasts got too close. His heart pounded so hard he wondered if the creatures could hear it. Ace kept his rifle trained on the filthy monstrosities. If it came to a gun battle, at least they had the drop. Claws scraped over asphalt. The pack slowly made their way toward Fitz, now only 10 or so yards away. They were so close he smelled their sour flesh. Ace shuffled at the side of his moving van, crouching for a better vantage. The closest beast approached Fitz, lashing a long tongue over sucker lips. It reared up on its legs, then let out a long howl. Fitz sighted the monster's head, sucking in a breath, ready to squeeze the trigger. A whistle came from the front of the CECO building. The small pack of beasts tilted in that direction and then, like dogs, took off together. They disappeared down 11th toward the CECO entrance. Fitz waited for their howling to abate, and Ace signaled it was clear. The duo followed the street to the corner of 11th, giving them a good view of the backside of the building. The monsters that had run down the street were gone, leaving the doors along the back unguarded. Ace had been right. There was a loading dock, but the large garage door was shut. Trying to gain entry would almost certainly attract the monsters they'd just seen. Fitz pointed to a fire escape tracing up the side of the structure. It led to several more doors and the flat roof. That might give them a way in. Fitz started to sneak toward the fire escape. Another whistle sounded from the front of the building. His earpiece burst to life, forcing him to stop and listen.
"Ghost One, contacts headed your way from the park and from the CECO entrance," Dohai said.
Ace ducked behind a dumpster, and Fitz dove next to him. Variants exploded from the park, their voices raised in a demonic chorus. The tap of claws against asphalt clattered down the street. Fitz and Ace pressed their backs against the dumpster, trying to remain hidden. They heard the clatter of galloping monsters careening toward their position, joints clicking. Then another pack flanked them from the south of the street, forcing the men around the side of the dumpster to hide. Soon, the meager shelter they had found would be worthless when the monsters stormed over their position.
"We gotta move," Fitz whispered to Ace.
He ran to the fire escape and scaled the ladder, his prosthetics clanging on the iron rungs. Ace followed him up. The monsters barreled down the street beneath them, heading in the direction of the whistling. Fitz couldn't tell who was calling the variants, but they had the monsters trained like disciplined hunting hounds. A loud shriek burst from the street. One of the variants froze amid the flow of the others. The diseased face turned up toward Fitz, and it wasted no time letting out an ear-shattering screech. The rest of the pack paused. The first time they had managed to evade the beasts, but not now.
"Faster," Fitz said.
He kept climbing as the variants jumped to the side of the building, ascending like spiders on the brick and using the webbing as a ladder. Dozens of jaws snapped and lips popped. One of the beasts jumped to the fire escape and leapt at Ace. He kicked its snarling face with a crack that knocked the beast backward. Fitz looked back up. They were almost to the top, but if there wasn't an escape door on the roof, they would be forced to engage the monsters. Maybe it didn't matter. By now, whoever controlled the beasts would have noticed them chasing after fresh prey. A chilling message hissed into his ear.
"Ghost One, hostiles on the roof," Dohai said over the comms.
Fitz got to the top of the roof to find four variants lingering between the thick vines of red webbing. He slid over the lip of the roof and fired a suppressed burst into the closest creature, then a second and third. Another shot, and the fourth was dead. He turned back to the stairs as Ace reached up. The sight below filled Fitz with cold terror. The entire side of the building was covered in crawling monsters. Fitz helped pull Ace over the side and then started to back up, looking for an escape. He saw a rooftop door, but another pack of variants had emerged behind it. Heads exploded in sprays of mist as Dohai picked them off. Fitz turned back to Ace and gave the order to open fire. The variants poured up around all sides of the roof surrounding them. They fired calculated burst after burst, knocking the creatures backward. But they kept coming, like always. They surged forward, driven by hunger and the desire to kill. The bolt on Fitz's rifle locked back. He ejected the magazine, grabbed a new one, and jammed it into place. Before he fired again, another shrill whistle sounded. The variants froze, nearly two dozen of them forming a circle around Fitz and Ace. The rooftop door burst open, and a chimera strode out, leading a squadron of ugly half-beast soldiers with faces covered in crooked scars, evidence of brutal surgeries to construct their frightening visages. Their reptilian eyes radiated a cold hatred, and their thin gray lips peeled back to reveal teeth that looked eerily similar to a normal variant's. Most had stubby claws at the end of their fingers, and their noses were squashed, nothing more than a pair of snake-like slits. They growled and spoke in gravelly voices, commanding Fitz and Ace to get down. The two operators came back to back.
"Boss, what do we do?" Ace asked.
Fitz's heart sank, fear wrapping its chilling fingers around his insides. Fighting would get them killed. Surrendering might too. It was either die now or take their chances and hope Dohai got away.
"Drop your weapon," Fitz said.
He lowered his rifle, and Ace did too. As soon as they did, the chimeras descended on them. The air reeked of melted plastic and burning oak. Ash fell over the outpost like snow as the last remnant of daylight faded over Lower Manhattan. The few surviving firemen struggled to put out the flames smoldering on what was left of the canvas tents and buildings. Fisher waited outside the 9/11 museum that served as the infirmary. With the command tent burned down, it now housed the temporary CIC. He took a deep breath, then removed his cowboy hat and shook some of the ash off the brim. He had stepped out of the museum for a breath of fresh air before his next strategy meeting. But like one of those brutal dog days of Texas summer, there was no cool, fresh air to be had. A glass of whiskey to take the edge off sounded like heaven right now. His old body wasn't used to the sheer volume of adrenaline that had been rushing through his blood vessels this past week. He checked his watch. It was time for his next meeting. Carrying his hat, he walked back into the museum toward the offices that had become the center of defensive operations. The groans of the injured filled the long makeshift hospital. Precious little medicine remained for those people. Fisher had heard that they would run out of the antibiotics and painkillers before the next morning. Seeing the suffering and knowing another variant attack would come sooner than later hit him harder than an angry bronc. But like trying to tame a wild stallion, the only way to beat past those thoughts was jumping back in the saddle. He stepped aside to let a pair of medics pass. They hurried down the rows of patients suffering gruesome burns.
God help their souls, Fisher prayed.
Seeing the injured reminded him of his wife's worst days when she'd been ill. How she had moaned and writhed, and how he had desperately wished he could change places with her to ease her suffering. There was nothing he could do for her then, and nothing he could do for these people now, besides prepare to defend them from the next attack. The sound of raised voices echoed off of the offices. Fisher left the medical ward and went to the temporary CIC for the imminent meeting. Officers sat around communications gear and computers. At one conference table, President Ringgold sat with Commander Massey. Chase and Chief of Staff James Soprano were busy helping a few officers set up new equipment. Fisher sat, placing his hat in his lap.
Madam President, he said politely.
A deep sadness filled her eyes, but it passed, and she turned to Commander Massey. Let's get started, Ringgold said.
I'll start with some good news, Massey said. Thanks to the president, we have a resupply coming.
Resupply? Fisher asked.
General Cornelius is sending air support and vehicles to assist with evac, Ringgold said. It'll take some time to organize, but should be here tomorrow.
Good, Fisher said. That means he can get the president to safety too, right? Or do we have another chopper on its way from command?
I'm not going anywhere, Ringgold said.
Pardon me, Fisher said, trying to conceal his shock.
I'm not abandoning the outpost, Ringgold said. Even if I wanted to, it's too dangerous. There might still be bats out there to take out air support.
Cornelius is sending advanced thermal detection systems complete with automated turrets, kinda like what the Navy uses in their automated phalanx SeaWiz systems, Massey said. With a little work, we can modify them to fire shotgun shells. Might be our only chance at preventing those suckers from tearing us apart again.
That takes care of our threat in the air, but we still have to worry about those on the ground, Soprano said.
He looked to Ringgold.
Sousa and Festa said they could send a boat, but...
No choppers, no boats, Ringgold said.
Massey took a deep breath.
Now for the bad news. After last night, we only have about 2/3 of our remaining forces in combat-ready condition.
Fisher had thought it was worse than that.
That's where you come in, Massey said, turning to Fisher. We need that early warning system back in place. I've got to organize the defenses here, but I trust you to find a good spot for the Vibersize truck. I'll send out a group of my best with you, and we'll reinforce whatever position you choose with everything we can spare.
Fisher stood.
You can count me in, man.
Massey waved over a group of soldiers led by a stocky, bearded man who had a thick head of dark black hair.
Sergeant Dwyer, Fisher's ready.
Yes, ma'am, Dwyer said. Follow me, sir.
Good luck, Ringgold said.
He tipped his hat at her, then waved to Chase. They tailed Dwyer out of the museum. A concrete pathway covered in ash led them between blackened trees. The Vibersize truck waited for them in the next street behind a Humvee and a repurposed Marine MRTV. The big Marine transport truck was already loaded with crates of weapons and materials for barricades to reinforce defensive positions. Two Bradleys idled behind the other three vehicles, and 20 soldiers stood around them carrying weapons. Some wore military ACUs, but others looked like civilians. Some of those civilians appeared too old or too young to fight. Dwyer gestured to the forces.
We're ready to defend that truck with our lives.
Me too, Fisher said. The sky had turned a shade of purple, darkness on the horizon. Deep in his mind, Fisher heard his wife's voice telling him to leave, to escape while he still could.
It's too late for that, he thought.
He wasn't going to cut and run now. Tran had given his life for this place, and Fisher planned on doing the same if it meant saving the people hunkered down here. Chase split off and hopped into the cab of the Viber-sized truck. Fisher followed Dwyer to the lead Humvee and stepped into the front passenger seat.
Where to?
Dwyer asked.
Start driving north.
Fisher pulled a map from his vest. He tugged his overgrown mustache as he studied candidate locations he had considered earlier. Guards opened the gate ahead. The convoy drove out once again into enemy territory, now getting closer and closer to the memorial. Fisher studied the past locations he had used. Bogardus Garden and City Hall Park were perfect locations, but the sinkholes and rubble of the previous attacks had ruined them.
We should pick a spot close to the outpost in case they need our help, or we need to retreat, Fisher said. A relatively open space would be best. Somewhere that doesn't have a jungle of water lines running under it if we want to prevent another sinkhole disaster.
How about Battery Park? Dwyer asked. Specifically, the ball fields.
Fisher looked at the map, pressing his finger on the spot.
Not a bad idea.
The caravan navigated between the burned-out vehicles and debris littering the streets, heading farther away from the memorial.
Always liked baseball, Dwyer said. How about you, sir?
Fisher smiled. He appreciated the sergeant shooting the shit with him.
Good American sport, he replied. I love the Astros.
I worked at a Quantico for a long time before the Great War. Love my Nats.
Maybe someday we'll see a game again, Fisher said.
Never count us New Yorkers out.
Fisher had been so focused on getting through the next couple of hours and mourning the death of Tran, he hadn't considered what might happen after the war. Hope was important, even if it was just a couple of men making idle chatter. As dusk settled over the city, any hope of a bright future seemed less and less likely. They arrived at the fields as the sun dipped behind the sky rises. The last rays of light cut between the buildings and retreated over the muddy, overgrown fields that had once been two baseball diamonds. The land was flat enough for the Viber-sized truck, and the towers around it would be perfect for sniper positions. And with the open ball fields, there was plenty of room for evacuation routes and space for all their other vehicles.
Good suggestion, Sergeant, Fisher said. This will do.
I'll start the barricades.
Dwyer relayed orders on the radio. The Viber-sized truck was parked between the two unkempt baseball diamonds, and the other vehicles circled around it for protection. Soldiers piled out and started setting up defensive positions. Others set off into the neighboring buildings to help the snipers find the best vantages. Fisher walked over to the Viber-sized truck as Chase stepped out.
You ready for this, son? He asked.
Chase sighed.
There are a lot worse places to die than on a baseball field, sir.
19. Dohai perched at the edge of an apartment balcony. The sun was hidden behind dark clouds, and shadows cloaked Seattle. He peered through his binos at the variants crawling over CECO like ants, using the webbing covering the building as scaffolding. On the ground, a group of chimeras held a tight perimeter street level. An hour had passed since the bastards captured Ace and Fitz. Dohai's pulse still hadn't returned to normal. He couldn't save them without being made.
Right, he thought.
He had constantly second-guessed himself, wondering if there was something he could have done differently. A shot he could have taken, or an opportunity he had missed to distract the chimeras and their monsters.
You can still save them.
Dohai retreated into the rooms covered in dust and mold. He considered his options again in the apartment. Trying to gun down the guards to get into CECO wouldn't work. He did not even have the ammunition to wage a one-man war against the forces he'd seen. Sneaking in through the roof would be a terrible decision, too, given that's where the enemy had captured Fitz and Ace. If going above ground wouldn't work,
That left one option. Dohai gathered his pack along with a few useful items he'd scavenged from the apartment building, stuffing them into his pack. He thought about the surrounding city block as he crept down the stairwell, boots smashing the layers of dust and mildew as he made his way street level. The webbing draping off the CECO building didn't spread past the surrounding block. For the facility to connect with the Variance communication network, the webbing had to go somewhere. The obvious answer was underground. Dohai navigated around the human bones and skulls littering the lobby. He stopped when an idea formed in his mind. Bending down, he carefully grabbed a few long bones and a couple smaller ones, stuffing them into his pack before pushing open the back door to the alley. From the alley, he couldn't see the CECO building, but he listened for the calls of the Chimeras and the Variant packs. When it was all clear, he maneuvered past a dumpster. Then he set out along the cracked asphalt until he reached a manhole. He pried it open as quietly as possible. The sour scent of rotting fruit escaped the tunnel. He flipped his NVGs down, then slowly lowered himself inside. The dark subterranean world came alive in a flood of green, white, and black. A current of fetid water flowed a couple inches deep in the middle of the tunnel. Webbing stretched over the concrete walls of the tunnel. A net of vines bridged over the surface of the water. Memories of being trapped in a tunnel like this surfaced in his mind. The webbing crawled over him, probing at him, worming its way around him as if it were trying to pierce his flesh. With a deep breath, he descended into the darkness, counting the steps and intersections to estimate his position under the apartment building. He headed toward where he presumed the CECO building would be. The echoing chatter of a pair of chimeras in the tunnel told him he was on the right path. He stopped as the webbing suddenly pulsed, throbbing as if it was pumping blood through a giant creature. If he made a misstep now, it wouldn't just be him strung up in this webbing. Fitz and Ace would share a fate worse than death as permanent captives of these chimeras. The chatter grew louder. It seemed to be coming from a lit-up T-intersection. Next to the corner of the intersection, Dohai flipped up his NVGs. He snuck a glance around the corner. Two chimeras stood at the end of a 20-yard stretch of tunnel in front of a steel door. Their reptilian eyes shimmered in the glow of lights hanging from the cracked ceiling. Webbing protruded through ports in the wall around the door. The door appeared to be secured by a keycard slot next to the handle. Dohai knew he couldn't sneak up on the two guards. Shooting them was an option, but even a suppressed shot would resound noisily in this enclosed space. Whoever was on the other side of that door might hear and lock down the facility, spoiling his plans. The only way in, Dohai figured, was drawing them away from their position and into his clutches. He had come prepared and retreated deeper into the dark corridor of the T-intersection. From his pack, he drew a small penlight and a length of long black Ethernet cable. He recalled the words of his grandfather as he set up the trap. Distraction is your enemy on the hunt, but it is also your best tool. If you cannot catch your quarry unaware, catch them confused. He used the Ethernet cable to create a snare, placing the loop under the slow-moving water. Then he stuck the longer bones from the building into the netting. Next to them, he flicked on the penlight and directed the small light over the bones. The Chimera's eyes would be drawn to the penlight when they rounded the intersection, blinding them. Then he could take them out silently. But before that, he had to draw them away. He wasn't sure if he could get both to move, but he was certain he could draw at least one away. He snuck to the other darkened side of the T-intersection. There, he positioned himself in the shadows so that the corridor with the soldiers ran off to his left and the penlight was in view in front of him, just past where the Chimera's corridor intersected. Shedding his pack, he took out a smaller bone, holding it between his hands. The two beasts finally stopped talking, and he bent the small bone. The snap echoed down the corridor. He pulled out his knife and hatchet and crouched in the darkness. For a moment, he heard nothing. Then, a few trenchant whispers. A knock on the steel door, and it creaked open. Dohai's heart hammered. He He heard the voice of a third Chimera joining the other two. That hadn't been part of the plan. Footsteps splashed through the water toward his trap. The soldiers were close enough Dohai could hear them more clearly.
"Probably just a rat,"
one said in a gravelly voice.
"I'll split it with you," said the other.
Dohai listened for the third soldier. He only had one chance, and this last-minute variable added to his plan might screw it up. The splashing footsteps grew louder as Dohai waited. The first Chimera finally rounded the corner, leading with his rifle. His eyes immediately shot to the penlight and the bones. The second Chimera appeared, eyes drawn to the light too.
"Keep going," Dohai thought.
The first was almost to the snare.
"Just another."
When he hit it, the Chimera didn't notice. He started to move his foot until the snare tightened around his boot. He fell forward onto the walkway. Dohai didn't know where the third Chimera was, but he had no choice but to act now. He lunged from the shadows on the walkway. He wrapped a hand around the standing beast's mouth and sliced through the mutant's throat, letting him down slowly. As the fallen Chimera pushed himself to his feet, Dohai jabbed his knife through its neck. Blood sloshed out of the beast's mouth. Footsteps splashed down the corridor as he twisted the blade. Dohai turned with his hatchet in hand to face the final monster. He swooped around the corner and launched the weapon. The blade hummed through the air and cracked into the forehead of the monstrous beast. It sprawled backward into the murky water with a splash. Dohai hurried over, patted the beast down, and found a keycard. For good measure, he dragged the body around the intersection with the other two, then stripped one of the creatures. The filthy fatigues fit Dohai better than he expected. He pulled a mask off another dead guard, and then set off for the door with the keycard. The disguise wouldn't pass muster if anyone actually got close and caught him, but he hoped it would be just enough to cause confusion or doubt, giving him the extra second he might need in any future encounters. He reached the steel door and slid the card over the slot. A green light appeared, and the lock clicked back. Dohai slowly pushed open the door to the CECO facility. He was in. Now he had to find Fitz and Ace. Timothy watched the water from behind the wheel of the sailboat, searching for the gray flesh of variants cutting beneath the waves. The trip had gotten off to a rocky start. After seeing a pack of beasts on the shore, they had been forced to slip into a cove where they had waited for 2 hours in dense cover before the monsters moved on. Then the rain had picked up, soaking Timothy and Ruckley again as they struggled to relaunch the sailboat. Normally, Timothy wouldn't even consider sailing in a storm, but they hadn't really had much of a choice. Not with the thought of Mount Katahdin weighing heavily on his mind. Eventually, the storm had finally settled, and the waves had calmed. Their journey had gone more smoothly for the past hour. Now Timothy kept the sailboat close enough to shore to keep an eye on the land, but far enough to be out of the immediate grasp of any threats. Their luck, like the weather, could change at any moment, and he stayed vigilant, scanning for enemies. Ruckley was doing the same. The infection from her wound didn't seem to bother her now that the medicine had kicked in full force, but the damage to her muscle made it hard for her to hold a rifle.
"Any idea how long until Boston?" she asked.
Timothy looked at a map he had in a clear plastic Ziploc bag, then searched the distant shore for landmarks that might line up with it.
"Maybe another few hours at this speed," he said.
They were hardly moving now that the wind had died and the gray clouds from the storm were finally parting. Ruckley switched positions to the portside gunwale to look out to sea. He figured she was searching for swimming variants. She raised a pair of binos to her eyes.
"I think I see something," she said.
"What is it?"
"A ship. Looks like an old cruise liner."
She paused, not taking a breath.
"Oh, shit."
"What?" She hurried over and handed him the binos. When he took them, he saw what had her disturbed. Smoke billowed off the starboard side of the ship. The storm had concealed it before, but now he could clearly see it. He could even make out the small shapes of people on the top deck. Hundreds, maybe even thousands of them. These were some of the ships the government had used to help evacuate people from other posts. and they were in major trouble. Life rafts were being lowered into the water, but there didn't seem to be enough to hold everyone. "That's not the only ship," she said, pointing. Timothy scanned the water. Sure enough, there were two more farther away, both burning. He handed the binos back and started to turn the wheel to the port. "What are you doing?" Ruckley asked. "We have to help." "Help? How are we going to help?" "We can take a few people on board. Surely they have a radio too." "There's nothing we can do for them," Ruckley said. "And our mission hasn't changed. We go to Boston and we find a radio there without risking our boat and our lives." Timothy stared at the ships, conflicted. There were thousands of innocent people out there, and if he was estimating generously, maybe enough life rafts for a quarter of them. "If we go, we risk being overwhelmed," Ruckley said. "And how will you pick the few people from the thousands to save?" She looked at him, waiting for an answer. He gave it by twisting the wheel back toward the shore. She was right. While thousands of refugees burned and drowned behind them, he stayed the course for Boston. This was war, and they were losing. Every choice from here on out would be difficult. Anger replaced the hollow sense of horror at the senseless act that had led to all those deaths. This had to be the work of the collaborators. There was no doubt in his mind. "Here," Timothy said, handing Ruckley the map. "Maybe you'll have better luck than me figuring out exactly where we are." She looked out at the shore as the sun dropped toward it. In the final hour of sunlight, Ruckley figured out their location. "If that's what I think it is, we're about 5 miles from Boston," she said, pointing to a peninsula. "Better start taking us closer to shore." Timothy nodded. A cool sense of relief filled him as he guided the small boat back toward land. By the time they got within view of the houses along the shore, darkness was settling in, making it impossible to see. Waves lapped at the hull as they bobbed blindly in the water. There wasn't a single light in the distance where Outpost Boston should be. The moon emerged from behind the clouds, its reflections sparkling on the choppy water. "Do you see anything?" Timothy said. "Negative," Ruckley replied. His stomach started to twist. "We should see the lights from Outpost Boston by now." A cold wind blasted over them, and he shuddered. He was starting to worry the outpost had been destroyed, but as they sailed closer, a faint glow sparked in the distance. "There," he said. Ruckley stood, using her binoculars again. "Is it Boston?" he asked. She stared through the lenses, saying nothing. "Sergeant," he entreated, feeling afraid. "Is it Boston?" Lowering the binos, she walked back to the wheel and grabbed it. "Have a look yourself," she said, handing him the binos. He aimed them at the glow on the horizon. It flickered orange and red. The light was definitely Outpost Boston, but the glow wasn't from electricity. It was from fires. It was destroyed. They were too late. Timothy didn't want to believe it. He kept his eyes pressed to the lenses, hoping to see tracer rounds or hear the crack of gunfire, anything to let them know the outpost soldiers were fighting back, that someone out there was still alive. But as they closed in, he only saw flames and sporadic explosions. Then he saw something swarming in the air, silhouetted by the bright tongues of fire. "Bats," he said. It was then he realized what had happened to the ships. The collaborators had used their VX-99 infected bats to attack them. Ruckley steered them toward the burning outpost. "You up for this?" she asked. "I'm not running." "Good. Because there isn't anywhere else to go." Timothy took the wheel on the final stretch. Ruckley stood at the bow, helping guide them into the harbor. Other boats in the docks burned. Flames danced over debris and floating patches of oil. He navigated past the wreckage, careful to avoid embers swimming on updrafts of the air so they didn't catch the sails. An empty pier ahead seemed like the ideal place to dock, and Timothy pointed to it. "Take in the sails, then grab some rope," he said. Ruckley followed his instructions, grunting as she strained her damaged arm to lower the sails. She went to the bow as he turned them. They gently hit the side of the pier. She jumped out and tied them to the cleats on the dock. After grabbing the meager amount of gear they had left, Timothy dismounted and followed her down the dock. An explosion boomed into the air a few blocks from the harbor, the fireball rolling upward into the sky. Embers rained down as Timothy ran with Ruckley through the devastation. He inhaled smoke, then began coughing. Ruckley was coughing too, as she looked for another route. Finally, she pointed to a yard filled with shipping containers. The smoke wafted overhead from the buildings on the other side. Timothy ran through the maze of containers using the glow of the fires. A howl sounded somewhere above the crackle of fire. The shrill shriek didn't stop them from pushing onward. Ruckley led them around the containers until they reached a parking lot with a view of the razor wire top fences surrounding the outpost. On the other side, cars burned on the streets and bodies lay sprawled in torn heaps. A group of three variants hunched around a burned corpse, tearing pieces off like they were a pack of wolves. One looked in Timothy's direction, ropey meat hanging from between its teeth. Ruckley pulled on his vest, and Timothy shrank back into the shadows.
"Can't go that way," came a low voice, thick with an Irish accent behind them.
They both turned, and Timothy leveled his rifle at a man with a mutton chop beard. A baseball cap was pulled low over his face, shadowing his eyes. He held a submachine gun hanging from a strap over his chest.
"You're pointing those cannons in the wrong direction, friends," he said.
Timothy kept his gun up, but Ruckley lowered her rifle. Behind the man was a group of children and a few women peeking out of an open shipping container. The soldier waved them back inside. A loud cracking sounded in the distance. Timothy turned back to the outpost. A building nearly 10 stories tall began to collapse. As it fell, a furious cloud of dust and embers erupted from its base. The resulting shockwave sent a wave of smoke rolling over the feasting beasts. The creatures scattered, squawking as their popping joints carried them away. Timothy and Ruckley dodged around the shipping container. The man with the submachine gun jumped inside with them, closing the door to seal out the rolling cloud of debris pounding against the container. The metal sides trembled as Timothy scanned the inside of the long container. There were 10 people in here, huddled together, shaking with fear. The Irish guy was the only soldier.
"We need a radio," Ruckley said. "You got one?"
"Afraid not."
He leaned down to look at her name tape.
"Sergeant Ruckley."
"Why are you still here?" Ruckley asked.
"The last ship pulled away before we could get aboard," the man replied.
"He came back for us," said a woman.
Timothy pictured the ships burning out at sea.
"It's probably better you didn't make the ships."
"What do you mean?"
the soldier asked.
"They didn't make it very far," Timothy replied.
The Irishman hung his head.
"Goddamn bastard collaborators."
"So what's your plan now?" Ruckley asked.
"We hide. You?"
"We need a radio," Timothy said, "which means we've got to search the outpost."
"You'll die," said the man. "Variants are everywhere. Only way to escape them is by sea. Getting into Boston on foot would be hell, unless you've got a set of wheels."
"Did any survive the attack?" Timothy asked.
The Irishman stroked his whiskers, thinking.
"I have a truck."
"Where?"
Timothy asked.
"Where's your boat?"
"Not far," Ruckley said, "but it's just a small sailboat."
The man seemed to brighten.
"Why don't you give up on that radio and take us all out of here on that boat?"
"No way," Timothy said. "I'm not leaving until we get a radio."
"Look, I need to get these people out of here. We can't hide forever."
The guy reached into his vest pocket and pulled out a set of keys.
"So how about this? I've got a truck. Might have survived, but I can't guarantee it. I'll trade it for the sailboat if you want to take the chance."
Timothy reached for the keys, but the man held them back.
"I'm telling you that you're going the wrong way," the man said. "It's suicide."
"I've been told that before," Timothy said, taking the keys.
20.
"Holy fucking hell," Parnell said. He was jacked up on morphine by the time they saw Denver from the stealth Blackhawk. Liam piloted the craft with the night vision optics from one of the former pilots.
They were flying dark toward their target outside the city, hoping to avoid anyone or anything that might still be alive. As they drew closer to their LZ, Beckham had a hard time believing anything could have survived down there. Moonlight illuminated enough of the city that the sight was breathtaking, but not in a good way. Command had fired one of the most advanced nuclear weapons left in their arsenal on Denver. A crater had swallowed the center of the city, demolishing the buildings and streets that had once crisscrossed the terrain. Instead of the normal airburst detonation, this nuke had targeted the variant hives and tunnel networks beneath the city. That had required subsurface targeting, resulting in the terrifyingly large crater.
"You sure anything is going to be left of this site?" Rico asked. "Maybe it's not even worth the risk of investigating."
"Good question," Beckham said.
He tapped the deck of the helicopter with his new leg, a contraption made of a metal rod, duct tape, and plastic debris that Horn and Rico had secured to his busted prosthetic. The result resembled a peg leg that a pirate might have sported centuries earlier. But as long as he could walk, Beckham didn't give a shit. Walking meant he could fight, although hostile forces weren't the only threat here. The entire city was radioactive from fallout. To protect his body, he wore one of the CBRN suits like the rest of the team, but Liam had refused to put one on.
"You really don't want a suit?" Beckham asked the pilot.
"No, I can't use the night vision with the suit and visor on.
Radiation is still going to be at lethal levels."
"I understand the risk. But if I can't fly with NVGs and we all crash, then none of us survive."
"At least nothing's left to eat us down there, right?"
Horn said, his voice slightly muffled behind the mask and respirator. He checked the tape over his gloves and sleeves before opening the side door.
"I wouldn't be so sure about that," Rico said.
She got up for a look outside.
"No, but it's better in Seattle," Horn said. "That place must be a nightmare."
He froze, probably realizing his insensitive remark.
"Fitzy can handle it," Rico said.
"I know. I didn't mean anything by that."
"It's all good, big guy," Rico said.
She slapped Horn on the shoulder. Beckham checked over his suit again as they prepared for landing.
"Hold on tight, okay, eh?" Liam said.
"Farnell," Beckham said,